Okay, so now we're in the middle of Hanukkah, and hopefully, so far we've been inspired by the lights of Hanukkah the past few days. I want to discuss today kind of a deeper perspective on Hanukkah. One thing I tried to do in this class overall, which I hope I'm getting the message across, is to show people how, and I think really anywhere I teach, I try to show how the Torah is much more than meets the eye. There's a lot of deeper ideas there, which we're not always aware of. A lot of times we have a very basic understanding, you know, of mitzvahs of Torah from when we were kids, and that remains with us our entire lives. But really, there's so much more depth and meaning to Torah in every mitzvah, every single holiday, every single story, much more than we're used to. You know, we've been through a lot of mitzvahs, we've shown our mitzvahs that we knew the basic concept of. There's a lot of deeper lessons and concepts behind them. And it's certainly like that with the holidays, the Jewish holidays, both the biblical holidays, the rabbinic holidays, all of them have a lot of depth. They're coming from somewhere far beyond the story which we're aware of from when we were kids. So the Hanukkah story, we know the Hanukkah story, a battle with the Greeks, a victory, lighting the menorah, and that, you know, just about every Jewish child who has any Jewish education is well aware of that story. But we have to understand that if you have a holiday which is instituted by the rabbis, and certainly by the Torah, it's not just a one-time event which happened to occur. It's not a coincidence the Greeks happened to be the empire in the world. The Greeks happened to overtake the land of Israel and happened to persecute the Jews. It wasn't just a coincidence. It was coming from much deeper roots. It was really an epic clash of good and evil, you know, coming out and it's, you know, blossoming into a war between the Greeks and the Jews, but it's coming from much deeper ideas. I mean, just as a simple analogy, you know, if someone says, you know, what caused World War I? So one answer would be because they shot the Archduke, right? But obviously, that's not what started World War I. There's a lot which happens, you know, many years behind that, all different countries in Europe, a lot of tensions, a lot of political problems, you know, land battles back and forth. Okay, so culminated in the fact that the Duke was shot and therefore we end up war. But there's so much more behind it, which was behind the scenes prior to that Duke being shot. So it's the same thing, I mean, even more so with Torah. The fact that the Greeks came and persecuted the Jews was just, you know, that was just the clash of ideology coming out into, you know, into a fruition. But really, this clash of ideology, you know, goes way, way back, and it's an inherent struggle in the world from day one, which happened to blossom at that time in history when the Greeks attacked the Jews. But it was something which came from much before that. So we have to be trained to view the Torah from a much deeper perspective. It wasn't just a one-time event which occurred, but this is an expression of a much deeper clash of ideologies, of philosophies, of good and evil, which again came out in a battle, but it comes out in a lot of ways also. So I want to try to discuss that concept and show what are the roots of this whole battle between the Greeks and the Jews, and also how do we take that philosophy of the Greeks and apply it to our lives, because there are a lot of positive values of Greek philosophy as well. I mean, Greek society introduced to us so much in terms of science and architecture and music and philosophy. There's a lot of positive elements to Greek society, but yet Hanukkah is a holiday which we celebrate over the fact that we were able to conquer the Greek society and Greek culture. So we have to put it all into perspective. So I want to take it back and to understand that when we find forces of evil in the world, they're not just random forces which rise up against us, but rather, you know, they are essential forms of evil which are there in the world, and they manifest themselves in different times, different places, in different ways. Everything has deeper roots. So let's understand what I mean by that. Let's trace back the roots of the evil of Greece. We'll talk about the positive aspects as well. Let's first trace back the roots of the evil of Greece. Obviously, it was an evil which came to attack the Jewish people, created a historic and epic battle, and created a yontif we celebrate for that victory. So we have to trace it way back to the beginning of the Torah. It says when God was creating the world, God created a world with a purpose. God created a world with going in a certain direction. He wanted people to have freedom of choice so they could accomplish. If we didn't have any challenges in life, there weren't any, if everything was just God, everything was just good and from God, so then we'd be robots. We would just do the right thing and the world would be full of robots. God had to present us challenges. God says, you know, your goal is to connect the world back to God once again, but you're going to have challenges along the way. There's going to be forces of evil, which I put into the world to challenge you. Now, Judaism doesn't believe that forces of evil are separate from God, but really they're God's tools to challenge us. So at creation, God says, I'm creating a world, but the world's going to have its challenges. But if you overcome those challenges, you'll connect the world back to me once again. And through that, the world will reach its fulfillment. That's the goal of the world. So it's the second verse in the entire Torah. Let's pull it out here. The second verse in the entire Torah. The Torah begins that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The very first verse. The second verse, it says, the earth is silver voho, the land was void and empty. The choshech al panei sohom, and there was darkness on the face of the abyss. Ruach Elohim, and the Spirit of God, Merachefes, was hovering on the surface of the water. It's a very enigmatic verse in the Torah. It's hard to understand exactly what it means. But it describes some forms of, you know, darkness and lacking in the world. There's void, there's emptiness, there's darkness, there's an abyss. It sounds like, you know, a little dreary image of what the world looked like. So the rabbis tell us that these four different terms, these allude to the four basic forms of evil in the world. And those four basic forms of evil can be expressed in many different ways. So one way we can express it, I'll describe in a second what kind of evil we're talking about. It's expressed through different empires which ruled the world at certain times in history. And it's expressed in our own daily lives and challenges. So the rabbis say that, I'll just tell you the quote. The rabbis tell us that the term sohu, the emptiness, refers to Babylonia. There's a kingdom of Babylonia, which was the world power for a certain period of time in world history. They destroyed the first temple. They sent the Jews into their first exile from the land of Israel. They're referred to as emptiness. There's Vohu, let's call it void. So that refers to the Persian Empire, which was the story of Esther and Mordechai and Haman was during when the Persian Empire was ruling the world. That was during what we call Galus Paras, when the Jews were exiled into the Persian Empire. That was in between the first two temples. And that's the second form of evil in the world. There's a third form of evil. They say Choshech, the darkness refers to Greece. The Greek Empire, which again was the other world power which subjugated the Jews, the story of Hanukkah. And then there's something called the Abyss, that refers to the Roman Empire, which was the fourth ancient empire which destroyed the Second Temple, sent the Jews out into exile, and we live in that exile to this very day, the Roman Empire. So these are the four kingdoms, the four exiles, and the four kingdoms which come up against the Jewish people. So historically, there were definitely empires which these represent. You know, there was Babylonia, Persia, and Greece, and Rome. But these aren't just historical events we're alluding to. This is in the very second verse of the entire Torah. This is long before there was ever a country of Rome or an empire of Persia. This is thousands of years before that. But what are the rabbis telling us? That there's four essential forms of evil in the world. They might be represented through these nations, which they were, but they're represented in other ways as well. So what are the four forms of evil? The Maharal, the famous commentator of the Maharal, he describes these four forms of evil. He says that, why is it four? Remember, nothing's random in the entire Torah. Even four is an important number. So the Maharal, he describes for us that when you have a center point, then you can veer away from that in four different directions. You know, there's four directions, north, south, east, and west. And there's a center point. So it's as if the center point is our goal. That's where we're all focused. We all should be heading towards that center point. But yet, we can be distracted and taken away in four different directions. You can go north, south, east, or west at that center point. And northwest is just a combination of the two, you know, north and west, but essentially you have four different ways you can go. That's why you have four different powers of evil. Because evil, in its most basic sense, is those things which draw you away from God. God is our center point. We're all heading towards God. Evil is something in the world that takes you away from God. So what are these four different forces that take you away from God? And this is what the Maharal explains. Maharal explains that these four forces can be divided into four categories. Number one, you have physical evil, a drive towards physical pleasure, towards lust, towards physical desires, hedonism. That's one thing. That's one form of evil which draws you away from God. You're not a bad person. You know, it could be, you know, I want to believe in God, I want to perform God's Torah, but I just get so drawn by the moment into my pleasures and lusts. I can't always fulfill God's will. The second form of evil, which the Maharal calls, is the evil of the word he uses is nefesh, let's call it the emotion. The drive for control, for power, for honor. So it's different than a physical drive. You know, if someone who just all they want all day is food or women, that's a physical drive. Somebody who wants power is different. That's an emotional need. I want to be in control. I want people to honor me. I want to feel that way. It's not that's a different form of evil, which can draw you away from God. No, God is in control. Somebody becomes very arrogant. That's a form of evil which draws you away from God. But that's evil not of the physical body. It's evil. I'm calling it evil of the emotion, I guess, is the best way to put it. There's a third form of evil, which is the evil of the mind. Bad ideas, intellectual evil, bad philosophies. That's something a person might just have, you know, thought or studied or learned from somebody who teaches bad ideas. And these bad ideas can be ideas that draw you away from God. It's an intellectual evil. So physically, I know I'm not drawn by my pleasures. I'm in control. Emotionally, I'm not arrogant. I don't have any drive for power. But yet, the thoughts in my mind are not godly thoughts. They're not the thoughts that God wants the person to have. And these are thoughts that draw a person away from their purpose in life. And there's a fourth category, which I'll have to explain more. It's a little harder to understand. Is the all-inclusive evil. It's the category of absolute evil. That it's coming. And the way I'd understand it is that someone who's taking away from God for that purpose, because they want someone who's rebellious against God. So somebody who has bad ideas, they're not trying to go up against God. It just happens to be they understand the world in their own way. Somebody's drawn after their lusts. So it could be I want to be a devout person, but I struggle with my drive for chocolate cake. And you know, and I'm always running for my chocolate cake, and if it's kosher or not kosher, I'll eat my chocolate cake. And you know, the fact that it's bad for my health, and the fact that it makes, you know, all these things, that's not essentially going against God head on. That's just, you know, it happens. It could draw you away from God. I mean, it could lead certainly to adultery, it could lead to incest, it could lead to other things as well.
Chocolate cake?
Not chocolate cake. I drive for lust and pleasure, that's what I mean. Hopefully chocolate cake won't lead you there, you know.
Where do you get that chocolate cake?
What about cholesterol?
Cholesterol, yeah. Those things, they're not head up against God, but it's just, it can happen to draw you away, you know, you get pulled by it.
I need a better definition on absolute, though.
Absolute. So absolute is saying that it's somebody who is going up against God for the purpose of rebelling against God.
Oh, wow.
That's absolute evil. It means that no matter how I can get you, whether it be through the physical, or the emotional, or the intellectual evils, I just want you not to serve God. That's the fourth form of evil. The other three forms, they in and of themselves could be neutral in terms of, you know, they have no opinion on God. God's great, but you know, but this draws me away. I'll try to elaborate more as we go through. That'd be the fourth category. So this is the four basic evils. These are represented by these four empires. Classically in Jewish thought, you have the Babylonian Empire. If you read throughout the Tanakh, Nebuchadnezzar's rise to power, the assault of Babylonia on the world, it was a drive for power, for glory, for honor. They wanted control, and that was what they wanted. That was Nebuchadnezzar. He was the one who came and destroyed the first temple. That was their goal. Was we want to have control over the world. We want you to be under our auspices. The Persian Empire. So you read the Purim story. Ahasuerus spent 180 days partying, made another party. All he cared about was enjoying himself. Right? The Persian Empire represents the form of evil, the physical form of evil. We just want to enjoy, have a good time. You know, so, and it says, you know, they're very happy to, it says that the rabbis tell us that at his party, the food was kosher. He offered kosher food to the Jews. You could take your airplane meal, eat it at the corner, I'm giving you kosher food. I don't think it gets Jews per se. I just want to have a good time. The problem with Jews is that a lot of times you prevent me from that because you say there has to be, you know, limits, moderation, morality. But I have nothing against Jews per se. If you want to come and have an airplane meal in the corner of my party, you're welcome. I'll serve it to you. Kosher wine. The rabbis tell us that this party offered kosher food. That's the rabbis say. But you see, if you read the Megillus Esther, which is our portrayal in the Bible of the Persian Empire, all they were out, for pleasure, physical pleasure. Greece is the intellectual challenge. Greece, we know that, and to this very day, modern understanding of philosophy, of science, of medicine, a lot of it originated in ancient Greece. Ancient Greece is looked at in terms of culture, they really were the foundation of modern culture, and modern understanding. All the earliest philosophers were Greeks, you know, Aristotle and Plato, these are all Greek. And a lot of discoveries in science and architecture, everything else, art, they are all Greek. Greek represents the challenge to the intellect. The Greeks, they weren't against God per se. They just said that if we don't understand it, we don't want to deal with it. Our minds can't understand your Torah, so we don't so we can't tolerate that. Not because we want to rebel against God. I mean, they happen to have their own gods, too. Their own gods are very understandable by the human mind. If you read Greek mythology, their gods were just people with extra, who were very strong people, basically, who also had lusts and drives, and they stole, and they murdered, and they pillaged. That's what their gods did. Because they actually created a god they could understand with their minds, because they had all to fit their minds, the Greeks. If it didn't fit in my, if it doesn't fit in my mind, then I can't deal with it. So Judaism is something which, and we don't understand everything. We say God's infinite. We don't understand God 100%. A lot of mitzvahs in the Torah, we don't fully understand them. We talked about chukim, those mitzvahs which we say, you know, wholeheartedly are not understandable mitzvahs. They're not rational. We do them anyways because God says they're the right thing to do. The Greek mind said, I can't tolerate such a thing. My mind has to understand it, or else I'm not going to do it. I can't understand your God, an infinite God. I can't understand infinity. I can't understand someone being all-powerful. I can't understand a lot of Jewish concepts, so we can't deal with it. That was the Greek mindset. So that's the Greek Empire. The Roman Empire, which traditionally stems from Esav, who was, you know, the foil of Yaakov and the Jewish people, so they're looked at as the ones who, what they did, they were coming out straight against God, as we view the Roman Empire. Amalek is associated with Esav as well, and we associate him with that same ideology, which we've mitzvah to kill Amalekites. Anybody's car here that we know? I hope not. Okay. So they're looked at traditionally as they're coming up against the Jews just for the sake of it. They could not tolerate the Jews serving God, which is interesting to think about, that concept. If you read how the rabbis portray the destruction of the temple and what the Romans did, you see a lot of that spirit going through all the descriptions in the Gemara destroying the destruction of the temple in the second exile. Additionally, we view this entire period since the destruction of the Second Temple until now as the Roman exile. And throughout this period, every form of evil has come up against us, whether it be persecution, intellectual ideas, physical pleasures. You know, they tried to be nice to us, make us assimilate, they tried to be mean to us and kill us. I mean, every possible way to persecute the Jews has happened since the Roman exile, because it all falls under the same rubric of we're here just to get rid of the Jewish ideal. Not for any other reason, not for our own pleasure, but to get rid of you. We don't like you. And we've seen it. We've seen it over and over again.
But you're making it with the emotion, if I'm correct.
No, the emotion was Babylonia. Rome was the all-inclusive.
Okay.
Rome is the all-inclusive.
Thank you.
And again, if we look at our current states, you know, as a continuation of what the Romans did, so trace your history the past 2,000 years since the temple was destroyed in the year 70. Since then, they've tried to kill us. They've tried to make decrees against our religion. They've offered us bad intellectual ideas, which would draw us away from God. They've tried to assimilate us by being friendly. They've tried to, take control over us. I mean, every single possible way, evil form of evil has hit us during the past 2,000 years. And that's all a result of the Roman exile. So that's how the Maharal describes these four forms of evil. So there is an empire which represents them, but there are ideas which happen to us in daily life, and there's struggles. We have personal struggles with these things. We have personal struggles with the drive for pleasure, personal struggles with the drive with arrogance and the drive for power and control. We personally struggle with ideas sometimes, are these Torah ideas or not, are these Jewish ideas or not. We have struggled with all these things. So to take it back to Hanukkah, so Greece, we said, is the source of evil of the intellect. That's what Greece is all about. They try to draw the Jews away intellectually, meaning that if you want to become Greek and think like us, act like us, they said, that's fine. And we're very happy to accept you. You can join us. You can participate in the Olympics. We're very happy to have you in Greece. You know, join us. And the Hellenistic Jews, they took on that philosophy. If you want to stick to your religion, which contains things which are not understood by the human mind, which makes you believe in an invisible God who's an infinite, which the human mind just can't comprehend 100%, so we can't tolerate that. That was the Greek philosophy. If I don't understand it, it's irrelevant to me. And we discussed this anymore at length last year. I'm not going to go into it as much today. But if I don't understand it, it doesn't exist. It's irrelevant to me. It doesn't affect my life. I have to understand it. And if it can't be understood, then no, I'm not dealing with it. And that was the Greek philosophy, which came up against Torah philosophy. Torah philosophy is that the starting point is not my mind. The starting point is God. We believe that God is infinite, God's all-knowing. He tells me to do X, Y, and Z. I try my best to understand it, but whether I understand it or not doesn't matter. I still have to perform God's will because God knows best. And hopefully, eventually, I will understand it. That's the Jewish philosophy in a nutshell. The Greek philosophy says it starts with my mind. My mind is the arbiter of truth. If I understand it, then I do it. If I don't understand it, it must not be real. That's the Greek philosophy. And that comes up, that's a major clash. And that's where, you know, the ideas, we'll discuss where that fits into our lives, because there is a lot of positive that comes from Greece as well. But the idea of science is that everything the human mind can understand works in science. Miracles, science can't deal with, because the human mind doesn't understand how a miracle works. It's not a pattern. It's not predictable. Science began in Greece. That's where our modern science began. And yeah. Greek philosophy, what is that? That means the human mind trying to figure out the meaning of life. That's what philosophy is. We're not taking it from it. The Torah says there's an outside source called God who gave us the meaning of life through the Torah. Philosophers say, no, we're going to use our own human mind, rationally, intellectually figure out what's true, what's false, what's moral, what's immoral, what's ethical, what's unethical. It's all based on my mind. My mind determines it. It's not determined by anything else. We say there's absolutes. God gave us absolute truth, absolute morality, absolute ethics. Whether or not my mind gets it doesn't matter, because ultimately that's what God says is the absolute. So that's the clash of ideals which is there. Greek culture and philosophy isn't evil. It's one of the evil empires which we go up against. And Hanukkah is a holiday which marks the destruction of, at least the Jews' destruction of the Greek philosophy, which was attacking them at the time. And the Greek Empire continued on after a while for another, I don't know, 100 years or so, historically. But in terms of their threat on the Jews, we dampened that threat on Hanukkah. You know, it wasn't totally finished. You know, we still have the Hellenists remain with the Jews till the destruction of the Second Temple. But on Hanukkah, we fought and we won a battle. That's what we're celebrating. So it's a historical battle, not just over one empire that happened to invade the land of Israel and disturb us, but it was the expression of an essential form of evil in the world, which came out in a battle in Hanukkah. So just like, you know, we look at Purim as a fight against the Persian Empire. You know, Haman and Ahasuerus coming up against the Jews. We look at Hanukkah as a fight against the Greek Empire, which is this philosophy of evil of Greece. Now, where does it fit in our lives, though? Because, again, you find, if you look throughout the works of the writings of the rabbis, in the Gemara, in the Midrash, everywhere, even in the Torah itself, we find references to Greece which are very positive. And there's a place for Greek ideals in Jewish life. And I wanted to discuss that. The development of the world, you know, after creation, first came through Adam and Eve, and then came through Noah. Noah had three sons. His three sons were Shem, Cham, and Yefes. Those were his three sons. Noah's three sons represent, you know, that was the creation of the world after the flood, which is our world. We live today after the flood. We live today. We all are generated by Noah and his three sons. So there's a fascinating idea discussed by Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Rav Hirsch describes that these three sons of Noah, they represent three different, let's call it, you know, motivations of people in the world. So just like we broke up evil into four different areas, we can break up motivations of society in three different areas as well. And I'll explain that also. But this is going to teach us where Greek philosophy and Greek culture fits into Jewish life. So let's talk about it. The story goes at the very end of Parshas Noach. Where is it? At the end of Parshas Noach, the story goes that he got off the ark. You know, God showed him the rainbow, promised him not to destroy the world again. Then there's a very interesting episode where Noach gets drunk and he exposes himself. It's always very strange to read. He was considered a very righteous man. God saved him from the flood, and then he goes ahead and he gets drunk and exposes himself in his tent. Why that happened, how that happened, it's a different discussion, but it happened. So it says his son Cham saw that his father was naked, and he went and told all his brothers. So instead of covering up his father and reducing his father's shame, he went and he said, "Hey guys, check it out, look at our father, look at him." You know, so he went and did a very shameful act to embarrass his father. The Torah records that shame initiated the process of covering him up, and Yefes helped him out in a supporting role. It says that shame grabbed a sheet to cover up his father, and Yefes and shame together, they took the sheet, they walked in backwards not to look at their father, and they covered him up. That's what the Torah relates. So we see three different roles. You know, Cham did something very shameful, a very terrible act of embarrassing his father. Shame took initiative to cover his father and honor his father. And Yefes supported Shem in that role. So those are the three sons of Noah. Noah wakes up, he becomes sober, he finds out what happened to him, and he curses Cham and he blesses his other children. He says, Actually, the curse was put on Ham's son, Canaan, because Ham already had a blessing from God. He didn't want to curse Ham. But he gave a curse to Ham's son, Canaan, as a punishment for Ham. And it says, cursed is Canaan. He should be a slave of slaves to his brothers. And then he said, blessed is God, the God of shame. And Canaan should be his slave. And then it says, Yaftel Kimu Yefes. God should beautify and expand Yefes, the third son of Noah. And Yefes should dwell in the tents of shame. And Canaan should be his slave as well. So the three sons, one is cursed to be a slave for his brothers for all of history. The blessing given to shame is that God is the God of shame. It's a statement. Your God is, Hashem is your God. And then Noah tells Yefes, God should beautify and expand you, but you should dwell in the tents of shame. That's what he tells Yefes. So first says, you can divide these three people into three different, let's see, motivations in the world, types of society, types of cultures. And we can understand a lot of where these cultures fit in and where how they should relate based on this story. But first says that you have one drive in the world, as we mentioned before, is a physical, animalistic drive. Drive for pleasure, physical lust, that's one drive in the world. That's the animal side of a person. You then have a side of a person which isn't spiritual, but yet it's a human side of a person. Art, philosophy, science, music, architecture, beauty. Animals, don't have these types of motivations. Animals don't produce art and don't appreciate beauty and philosophy and understanding like a human being does. But yet these aren't spiritual motivations. These are human motivations. So there's the animal side of a person, which is the physical drives. There's a side of a person which is culture, what's called the cultured side of a person. That's the human side. That's a person that's missing their human element. That I'm not an animal, I'm human, so I appreciate things which are a little bit higher up. Beauty, culture. And then you have spiritual drives. A person's drive to connect with God, to reach beyond for sanctity, for morality. These are spiritual aspirations. That's the third motivation of the world. And societies and people all function based on the three motivations. Now, some societies seem to be mostly pursuing their physical pleasure. Some seem to be mostly pursuing their spiritual goals. And some seem to be pursuing, this middle area of culture and philosophy. And then there's mixtures, obviously. And, there's different types of hybrids. Those are the three different motivations of societies in the world. So the three sons of Noah represent these three different streams of nations in the world. Ham, who was the one who did the shameful act to his father, his name means heat, which we would associate with lust or passion, physical drives. The forerunner, in terms of Ham's descendants, we view as either Egypt, Mitzrayim, or Canaan. If you see the way the Torah describes Egypt, or describes Canaan, it's called Ervas Aretz. It's the nakedness of the land. Very immoral societies. Very physical societies. They did abominations, the Torah says, in terms of ancestral relationships and it was a very hedonistic societies, and they were the descendants of Ham, and they were kind of the poster boys for Ham. You have then Yefes. Yefes, his one represents culture, the higher human element of a person. Beauty. His name Yefes means beauty. Yefes, Yofi in Hebrew is beauty. Yefes means beauty. It's his name, and the aspect of beauty and culture, understanding and arts and architecture that's attributed to Yefes. The forerunner, the poster boy for Yefes, is Greece, Yavan. He's a descendant of Yefes, and like we say, Greece is the high point of human culture. And in our society and culture we have this very day, a lot of it is founded and stems from ancient Greece. Shame, the name Shame means name, literally Shame means name. But when I say it means name, it means this is something which is the purpose. This is the substance. This is a name. This is it. This is what it's supposed to be. Shame was the poster boy for shame are the Jewish people. Abraham descended from shame. We descend from shame. And shame as the one who represents the spiritual aspirations of human life. So therefore, the poster boy for shame is going to the Jewish people who represent the drive towards God in the world. Now this could also be divided up, I think Rav Hirsch mentions, but this could use some further discussion, but you could divide it into Africa, Europe, and the Middle East, he says. Again, in a broad sense, you can think about that. Africa, Europe, and the Middle East. But those are the three sons of Noah.
So shame would be more in the intellectual?
So shame is the spiritual. Yefes is more of the intellectual. The ethos means, in terms of you're doing the ideals for a human being without bringing in God. So you're moving beyond animalistic drives. But so you're doing very human activities, but you're not spiritual activities. I think the idea of beauty and art and philosophy, that's and science, that's all human activities.
So shame would be like nefesh.
Shame could be like, I guess if you were to relate it to that before, I guess they would fit into both the
nefesh and
could be a mix of the nefesh and the intellect. Yeah. I'm not necessarily correlating it with what we said before, but we will see a correlation. I'm not trying to get to that yet, but I guess you could associate it with that.
The only reason I say it is oftentimes we think of a name.
Right.
We look at a billboard, we see a name.
Yeah.
A person who is making themselves bigger, posting a name, putting a name on a business.
Right.
Doing is that sort of being in the office, getting elected, see the name.
Right.
And that would be more of an egocentric
Right, I understand that. But the word taking name here is that this is, it says that Adam gave a name to all the animals. What does that mean? Adam understood the purpose of each animal, so gave it an appropriate name. The word Hebrew for name is shame. It's the same letters as sham, there, because my name tells me what's there, right? There's a substance to it. It's funny, this is the substance, this is the purpose, this is what the world's all about, is shame. So how do these three interact? So it says that Ham has to be a slave. Ham's position is to be a slave to his brothers, because physical drives let loose are destructive no matter what. They have to be kept in control, have to be moderated, they have to be subjugated to the human side of a person, which we discussed that in this class before as well. But a physical lust has to be put in its place, has to be slave to the rest of the person, period. A physical lust which is let loose is a very destructive force. So Noah says that Ham has to be a slave to his brothers. But then he says a very interesting thing. He says that God is the God of shame. So that means that the purpose of the world, God's goal is a person like shame. The person is reaching out to God, aspiring to connect beyond. That's shame. That's the purpose of it all. That's the substance of the world, is shame. That's our goal. But then it says that God should beautify and expand Yefes, and he should dwell in shame's tents. So this is where it comes. This is where Hanukkah comes up. We're dealing with the poster boy for Yefes is Greece. But it includes all the ideas of society and culture and philosophy and understanding and science, all the above, which don't deal with God, but deal with the finer side of human life. And it says that's appropriate, but if you are a guest in shame's tent. So let's give it an analogy. If I build a beautiful building, but the inside of it is empty, so it's meaningless. So it's just a facade. You go behind it, you go inside, there's nothing there. So you say, what's the point of it all? It's a waste of time. If there is a building, let's say you have a shul, and you create a beautiful building around the shul. So you say, wow, that's great, because it creates a great environment connecting to God, a great place to go and connect to other Jews, a place where you want to be, you want to learn, you want to grow. It makes you feel happy, makes you feel spiritual. So the beauty of the building, it supports, it plays a supporting role to the goal, which is to connect to God. If when you have a shul which is, kind of falling apart and dirty and so then, you're still in there, you're saying the same prayers, but it's not the same feeling, because you don't feel, it doesn't create the environment which you want to connect to God. But the Beis HaMikdash is a beautiful, beautiful building, gold and silver and marble, because it is the most spiritual place in the world, and the facade of the most spiritual place in the world should also contribute to what you're doing inside. So Yefes is this concept of the of beauty, of understanding, and what it's supposed to do is it's supposed to play a supporting role to the substance of life. Shame is the substance of life. Shame is we're reaching out, we're connecting the world back to God once again. We're connecting to our own souls, we're connecting ourselves to God. So if that's done, so shame, what he's doing, blessed is God, the God of shame. Shame is the goal. Yefes should expand and grow and become beautiful, but his dwelling place should be in shame's tents. Shame is in control, and he's acting as a partner to help shame produce his goals. That's what we do Yefes. Everything which is in the whole, sorry, one second, the whole gamut of Greek culture, architecture, philosophy, science, all these things should be used as bridges to help us connect to God. So to say that I'm going to take science and see that as viewing God's beautiful handiwork, that's the role of science in Jewish life. We should understand science very well because God produced the laws of science. To take architecture and use it to produce beautiful shuls and schools, mezmedrashes, and beautify our homes so we can have a special experience inside our homes, so that's appropriate. But to take these things and to take them out of the sense of shame and have them on their own, that becomes destructive for a Jew. To say I'm going to divorce science from God, so then what you're doing, that leads a person to heresy. Because science doesn't help you talk about God. You can't sense God through science. To say I'm going to make beautiful buildings, but they'll be empty inside. There's no substance to them. That's a waste of our time. Why are you building a beautiful building if there's no substance to it? To say I'm going to try my best to understand, use my mind to understand the world. So that's a very positive thing. But if you don't submit to the fact that ultimately God is the one who decides truth and, God is the one who decides morality, God is the one who decides purpose, so then what you've done is you've divorced your mind from God. And that's a terrible thing in Jewish thought. But to say I'm going to use my mind to understand and ultimately submit myself to God, I'm going to build a beautiful building, but there's going to be substance to the building. I'm going to view science, but see that as God's wisdom. That's an extremely positive thing for Jews. And the culture of Greece gives that to us. So we all want to have a Sefer Torah, we decorate a Sefer Torah, we put a crown on it, we give it a beautiful cover. And the concept is, it's the same Sefer Torah without all of that. You could wrap it in paper, but we want to beautify it because that helps us appreciate it more, connect to it more, and understand there's something really special here. But if you just had the wrapping and there's no Torah inside, so then it's a waste of wrapping. It's a waste of a crown. What are you crowning exactly? So that's the role. So Greek life should be viewed as Greek philosophy and culture should be viewed in our lives as Yefes in the sense of shame. Yefes has a place. He's not a slave. He is a partner, but the one in control, he's a supporting partner to the main partner, to the main player, which is shame. Shame is the main player. In other words, the Jewish people are the main players of the world, bringing the world back to God once again. The beauty of Greece should be utilized to help us get there and to help us appreciate and to connect better to our goals. You have a book. So a book, really the plot in the story of every book can be condensed into about a page and a half. Why is the book 400 pages? Because you're giving it excitement and humor and description and adjectives. But really, if you just take the very substance, the substance itself is hard to connect to. But once you give it a little bit of a flair and excitement and some humor and some charm, so then you get the substance and you appreciate the substance. That's what Yefes' role. If you just had black and white substance in life, and there's nothing to beautify it and make it palatable to us, and it's very hard to connect to it. It's a bridge. But Yefes uses that bridge to connect us to it. So you walk into an ugly, smelly shul where they're davening. It's very hard to connect because, yes, they're studying the same prayers as my sitter, but it's not. I can't connect to it. It's a beautiful building, and it's comfortable to go in, and it's very bright and nice, and people are dressed in their Shabbos clothes. So then it's a different atmosphere now. So now I can connect and feel the warmth of it. And that's where we should find the role. So Hanukkah is the time where, on the one hand, it's a clash between the Greek culture and Jewish culture. And Greek culture, in and of itself, is challenging and meaningless to us. But to take Greek advances and to use them and what Greece stands for and what Yefes stood for and use it to promote what we stand for, that's its role in the world, and that's where we should use it. And it's very appropriate to beautify a shul and to appreciate science in light of the fact that it's God's doing and to use our mind to understand the world and Torah to the best of our abilities. And that's an extremely Jewish ideal and everyone's encouraged to do so. But the minute you divorce your mind from God and say, if I don't get it, it can't exist. The minute you say that science in and of itself has meaning and therefore the world can exist on its own without God. Or the minute you say that I'm gonna put all my time and effort into making a beautiful structure with no substance to it, so then that becomes the clash of Hanukkah. That's where the Jews became Hellenists. The Jews threw off the belief in God. And that's what created the Hanukkah clash. Ultimately, we won that victory, and at least in that temporary battle, we showed that we can overcome the forces of Yavan, of Greece. But we still deal with it this very day, and we always have that temptation to fall into that society, into that culture, and that beauty. But we have to understand that has to be put into context. The beauty of Greece is beautiful in the sense of shame. The beauty of Greece is terrible on its own, and that's the Jewish view of Greek culture. So you have questions, Sam?
I understand that Greece, the economy was built on slaves.
That could be, right.
So,
yeah.
There's a lot of evil in the roots.
Right. But yet it does say that Cham should be slaves to Yefes. So if it's those people, Obviously, I'm not saying every single part of Greece is positive. I mean, there was a lot of immorality in Greece as well. You know, but the positive aspects of Greece, which there are a lot of positives to it, should be incorporated into Judaism with the proper perspective, but never taken on their own to be important. And that's how we view it. So the Chanukah is the time where we grapple with the Ephes, we grapple with Greece, we put it in its proper place. We can't appreciate the beauty for itself, we appreciate the beauty for that which it expresses. You know, a beautiful building, beautiful person. If there's a beautiful person, but they're empty people, so then we don't view that as positive. The person has a beautiful face, but they're lying and they're cheating and they're immoral. But a person is a beautiful person with a beautiful inside, that we view as a very positive thing. You know, and a lot of times the beautiful inside creates a beautiful person. You know, that expresses itself through how the person looks. You can see in a person's eyes. It's a lot of many times you see in how they look who they are. So that's how we have to view it. So Chanukah is a time where we're supposed to reflect upon these ideas. We're supposed to think about, you know, how do we relate to science and philosophy and architecture and everything we mentioned that comes from ancient Greece. Where does it clash with how we view it? Where does it fit into Judaism? And then how do we incorporate it into our lives in a positive manner? So that's the deeper roots of the Chanukah story, both in where the evil comes from, which is an essential evil in the world, and the proper place for where that form of evil can be used for good. Any other questions?